Okay. Now, one more thing for me to add is that your string that you wrap one with, wrap the tzitzit with your 39 windings, in other words, is called the shamash, which is the servant string. Now, this would be the one that was the tekelet, the blue colored. And the word shamash is a word that is used for Messiah. You know that you have the shamash, the servant candle, during the festival of Hanukkah. Okay, so you should be asking, what does this have to do with Yehezkel? What does it have to do with Ezekiel? So we'll now move into the spiritual aspects of this. First off, what is the purpose of clothing? Clothing is there to cover you. Only humans are the ones that wear clothing. A lot of times it has been thought by anthropologists and so forth that clothing was for the sole reason of protection. But they found that even in studying the most primitive of tribes in the warmest of climates, they still wore a degree of clothing. And the degree of clothing that they wore was over the sexual organs to more or less extent. In fact, what was discovered was that people covered their sexual organs in virtually every human society. So, going back to the Garden of Eden, we have Adam's sin. We have that the serpent, or Nakash, the Hebrew word Nakash, tempted Eve to eat of the tree of knowledge. The tree of knowledge is called Eitz Hada'at. Eitz, E-T-Z, Hada'at. H-A, capital D-A-A-T. The tree of knowledge. Now, I want to read this to you. The existence of a walking, talking serpent might seem difficult to understand, but our sages teach us that it was the very incarnation of evil. In order for man to have free will, at least the possibility of evil had to exist. Before Adam sinned, evil was not part of man, but something external. It was therefore represented by the serpent, an entity external to man. It was only after man's sin that evil became an integral part of this being. From then on, man's battles with evil became as much a battle with himself as one against an external force. Before Adam sinned, the Torah says of him, and they were both naked, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed. Genesis 2:25. Our sages comment that they were not ashamed because they had no sexual desire. Sex was as natural a body function as eating and drinking. It was something completely under man's control. Sexual pleasure may have been something that they could enjoy, but it was not the overwhelming passion that it is today, where it drives people to foolish and even destructive acts. Sex, like the serpent, was something external to man. Man could enjoy it when he wanted to, but he was not driven by it. Since sexual desire was not an integral part of man's nature, there was no shame in exposing the sexual organs. They were no different than his eyes, ears, hands, or feet. There was something that could arouse another individual, they were not something that could arouse another individual, or in any way make one feel like a sex object. Indeed, so innocent and natural was the sexual act that Adam and Eve did not even feel compelled to perform it in private. The external incarnation that led them to sin was represented by the serpent. It's a well-known fact that in almost every culture, the serpent represents some sort of phallic symbol. To a large degree, then, the serpent represents sexual temptation. Our sages teach us that the main temptation of the serpent used to lure Eve was that of sex. As soon as man sinned, he began to have an evil urge, or the Yetzer Hara, which you'll find on your paper, right under Shamash. It's the evil inclination, or the evil urge. Evil was no longer something outside of himself, but an integral part of his being. It was now a force that man could overcome only with the greatest difficulty. Yes, the Yetzer Hara. It's the evil inclination or the evil urge. Our sages teach us that the evil urge exists mainly in the area of sex. Very often, it is sexual temptation that leads a person away from religion and godliness in other areas. It is often the strongest barrier standing in the way of an individual's spiritual perfection. All right, so your next one that you have on your sheet here is the Lashon HaKodesh. It means the holy language. Lashon HaKodesh. Or the holy tongue. The Hebrew language. Besides the words, even its grammatical and etymological rules teach us important lessons. Okay, the Hebrew word for garment is lebush. I have misspelled. There should be an H in there. B-H-U-S-H. It comes from the word bush. Now, bush is spelled correctly. Bush means to be ashamed. So because you were ashamed, you have a garment. Because you were bush, you have le bush. Say that again.
Two, N, or four?
Is le?
Le, L-E.
Yes.
Is it Malbush or Malbush? I thought it was Malbush.
No, Malbush will come up later. Okay. Let me read the sentence to you. The very structure of the Hebrew language indicates that clothing is worn because of shame. Another Hebrew word for garment is beged. The Reuben Prager's company is called Beged Ivri. Garments of the Hebrews. Clothes of the Hebrews. Now, I've capitalized the consonants. Remember, in Biblical Hebrew, you don't have the vowels. It has the same root as the next word, begad, which means to rebel. You wear clothing because man originally rebelled against God.
Mr. Fraser's clothing that he produces, it's extremely close to what they had in the first century?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go down to the word tzitzit. If you'll remember that we had that tzitzit means to appear in visible form. It has the same root as the word zutz. T-Z-U-T-Z, which means to look. So tzitzit are therefore something that relates specifically to the sense of sight. In other words, something to look at. You're told concerning the tzitzit to look at them and to remember all of God's commandments and not stray after your eyes and your ears, or your heart and your eyes. Now please put in your notes God's talit. You should be asking, what does this have to do with Ezekiel 1? I'm going to give you a quote from Talmud Rosh Hashanah 17b, out of the Babylonian Talmud. Rabbi Yochanan, be Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan said, if it were not written in the Bible, it would be impossible to say. But we are taught that God wrapped himself in a talit, like a prayer leader, and showed Moses the order of prayer. He said, whenever Israel sins, let them proceed in this manner, and I will forgive them. Now, according to most biblical commentators, the biblical verse that he's referring to is from Daniel chapter 7, verse 9, where you have the Ancient of Days, which is called the Atik Yomin. Now, put that on your paper. The Atik Yomin, the Ancient of Days, sat there, his garment was as white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. The garment there is seen as being the talit. Also, from Psalm 104, we can turn there. This particular verse is going to be related to what I read to you from Rabbi Yochanan. It's actually verse 2, but I'm going to read verse 1 with it. Bless the Lord, O my soul, O Lord my God, you are very great, you are clothed with honor and majesty. Verse 2, who cover yourself with light as with a garment, who stretch out the heavens like a curtain. The garment there is seen as being a talit. Are you familiar with the term anthropomorphisms? I can't say it very well. Anthropomorphisms. Okay. In other words, that it says like the hand of the Lord. God doesn't have a hand. Okay. Not a hand like we have a hand. Or that the eyes of the Lord go to and fro over the entire earth. God has no corporal form. He has no body. He's called the invisible God. God is a spirit. But their terminology throughout the Bible is used that we can relate to. And so, it is where that God has given us an ability to relate. Yes?
In all these passages, with the term God's talit, this has nothing to do with the tzitzit.
It will.
Or it's a combination. Okay.
It's a combination, yes. Okay. So now we get into the big, deep questions of mankind. Here's a basic question. Why did God create the world? I mean, they could have gotten an easier question than that. Why did God create the world? Okay, we can understand God's reasons to the extent that they have been revealed by Him in the Torah. The account of creation ends with the words, God saw everything that He had made, it was good. This passage, other passages, teach us that God's purpose in creation was to do good. Now you have, for instance, Psalm 145, verse 9. God is good to all, His love rests over all His works. So, let me read. I have to read this to you. There's no way I can just break this down without doing that. But since God is infinitely and ultimately good, it would stand to reason that He wanted to give good to His creation. It would have to be the highest possible good. What is that? What is the highest ultimate good? The answer should be perfectly obvious. This ultimate good is God Himself. God thus created a world to which He could give of Himself. But how is this possible? In what way can God give of Himself? How can a mere man partake of God? Okay, it's easy. You partake of God by resembling Him to the greatest possible degree. The more we resemble Him, the more we partake of the ultimate good that is God. For that reason, God gave man free will. If man didn't have free will, he'd be poles apart from God. He'd be little more than a robot or a puppet. Now, I think everybody would admit that God is totally free to do what He wills. Nothing can hold Him back. But in God giving man free will, God gave him the ability to imitate God. In other words, to choose good as a matter of free will. Just as God chose good, so can man. The only problem is that man often doesn't choose good. He chooses evil. Okay, this brought up that God necessarily had to create evil. Okay? Let me read this. Therefore, just as God chose good as a matter of free will, so can man. But in order for his choice to be real, God had to create the opposite of good. He therefore created the possibility of evil, so that man would be free to choose between good and its opposite. God himself speaks of this when he tells the prophet, I form light and create darkness, I make peace and create evil, I am God, I do all these things. Isaiah chapter 45, verse 7. Okay. Hopefully I only have to read about one more paragraph here. Although evil does not fulfill God's primary purpose in creation, it does fulfill his purpose in a secondary way. In a sense, it is like the pill of a fruit or the shell of a nut. They are in themselves useless, but they serve the secondary purpose of preserving the fruit until it is used. The same is true of evil. It does not serve God's primary purpose of bestowing good, but it does not fulfill the secondary purpose of making it possible. Because of this analogy, the forces of evil are often referred to as the husk or klipa, which you should put in right here. After the Atik Yoman, write in the word klipa, K-L-I-P-A-H, which is the husk. K-L-I-P-A-H.
It's on the list.
It's on the list.
Down below, yes, it's klipat, which is a plural form, which would be husk. Plural.
Which you say is symbolic of the evil inclination?
No, it's evil in general. It's the klipa. Is a dark cloud that surrounds an inner light.
So the Jews have an opaque klipa and the Gentiles have a...
Stop and think. What came down on Mount Sinai?
Cloud.
A dark cloud with an inner light. What did Yehezkel see? A dark cloud with an inner light. Okay?
So that cloud is klipa. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Okay, now man has a task, and his task is to bring the world under the dominion of God. Okay, that is a task that all of us have been given. For the world to conform to God's plan, in this you become a partner with God. You work with Him. Now, we also have divine providence, where God works in our lives. Even though we have free will, there is divine providence. And God will bring people across your path. God will bring situations across your path, giving you free will in order which way to go. But He directs things so that they will come out to the conclusion that God has desired. In fact, Proverbs 21, verse 1, the king's heart is in God's hand. He turns it however He wills.
Now see that would...
Please. This is called Tzitzit by Ari Kaplan. A-R-Y-E-H-K-A-P-L-A-N. Okay, maybe this will help you. In a way, this situation is very much analogous to the game of a master chess player. although is impotent, has complete free will. The master knows how to counter each move and thus bring the game to any conclusion he desires.
Since God desires that all be saved, is that the ultimate end result of all individuals?
That might be a desire of God, but not necessarily the expressed desire. God desires that men choose to be saved. Well, see, God cannot take away free will. This is a major item here. Is God cannot take away free will. Okay, divine providence is called Hashgacha, which I put on here, I believe. Is it on here? Yes. Hashgacha is divine providence. Okay, now. Said I wasn't going to read to you, but on this stuff on evil, I'll state it wrong if I don't read it to you. Okay, first there is an element of providence that allows evil to exist. Since God's purpose requires the existence of evil, He must, in a sense, hold Himself back from utterly destroying it. I think we'd all agree with that. Therefore, although God is constantly guiding the world toward good, He still allows evil to exist as long as it serves His purpose. It is of this element of providence that our sages speak when they teach us, when one comes to defile himself, God opens the way for him. The second element of providence is that which protects from evil. Wherever man comes in contact with evil, God must at least give him the power to be able to overcome it. Furthermore, the power that God gives to evil must not be allowed to become part of His providence and thus make it malignant. Is it the second element of God's providence that our sages speak when they say man's evil urge becomes stronger each day, and if God did not help him, he would not be able to overcome it. In order for evil to exist, God must interact with it in two basic ways. First, He must allow it to continue to exist. And second, He must not allow it to overcome the good. Now we come to Ezekiel. Yes.
Can I get a copy of that next week? Maybe I sure would like to have one.
Talk to Daryl. Okay. Both of these concepts are alluded to in the beginning of the prophet Ezekiel's vision. He writes, "I looked, and behold, a stormy wind came out of the north, and a great cloud and flashing fire. It was surrounded by a glowing light, the Nogah. From its midst was the likeness of the Hashmal. From the midst of the fire, and in the midst was the form of four Hayot." Yehezkel 1:4. Where we started tonight in the paper.
So, Joe, concerning Mashiach, then the hope or the desire for Mashiach is not the rebuilding of the kingdom or the temple. It is the deliverance from the evil inclination.
Exactly. I mean, the temple is not the goal. The temple is not the goal. The temple is something that is visually there to teach you, to instruct you on God.
But is this a prevalent Jewish mindset? In other words,
yes.
Is that their desire for Mashiach?
Yes. Yes. It is the Messiah. That is why in Judaism the Messiah is not seen near in the category is the redemption. Okay? The Messiah is the agent of the redemption.
Or is that a king only in the sense that they hunger and thirst after righteousness, not necessarily that they do righteousness?
Well, yes, it's also going to be very important that they do righteousness.
What I'm saying, though, is if that passage that you just read, or that article that you just read, and I see it in the world that the evil inclination is getting stronger and stronger and stronger, even in the Zadok king.
Yes.
There's many, many people that are walking more and more after that than being more and more godly.
Yeah, that's more and more that's there. I mean, we're at the end of days. We're at the time that these things are increasing and increasing and increasing, and the pressures and just all kinds of things.
Well, that's the birth pains.
Well, that's the pre-birth pains. It's kind of like the Braxton Hicks. Okay? Okay. Now, the passage began. If you'll turn over to Ezekiel chapter 1. Now, we've got to get a considerable distance further. Ezekiel chapter 1. The passage starts in verse 1 down towards the bottom of the passage, that the heavens were open and I saw visions of God. Or simply a vision of God. Ezekiel was seeing beyond the mere appearances of the world, and he was seeing, he was perceiving an understanding of God's purpose and providence that underlies it. Now, this is a new aspect of our last week. Let me repeat that. He was seeing beyond the mere appearances of this world and achieving an understanding of God's purpose and providence that underlies it. The Maaseh Merkavah could be defined as that on one level. Now the first thing that he sees is a stormy wind, a great cloud, and a flashing fire. The sages, going all the way back, we know, to the Talmud and Midrashim before that, so this would have been there at the time of Yeshua, teach us that these allude to the forces of evil that God allows to exist. In other words, that he saw, in verse 4, I looked and behold, a whirlwind was coming out of the north. This is the forces of evil. You have a great cloud and a flashing fire. All of that, the forces of evil. These are the forces that separate man from God. The prophet, as well as the individual, has to break through them before he can actually see a vision of God. The next thing that the prophet saw was a glowing light, the Nogah. The sages define the Nogah as being the element of God's providence that sustains evil. It's merely a glimmer of God's light. It's kind of like sunset. Or the glow that you have in the sun, in the sky, after the sun is set. With the Nogah that he saw was just a glimmer of the providence of God that sustains evil. You can relate this to a passage in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. He who letteth will let until he be taken out of the way. The Nogah.
Is that the shell of the nut?
Okay, it's very good. It is often referred to as the glowing husk. The Klipat Nogah.
The light or the wind round fire?
The light. The glow. The light that he saw where you see... Yeah, Ezekiel, let's see. A great cloud with... I have a raging fire engulfing itself. Okay, but this is the Nogah. It is the light inside. It is a... It holds back evil. It's the Klipat. The storm is the Klipat, okay? But the light is the Klipat Nogah. It holds back evil. It is what is up on the body of Messiah at large. Okay, let me continue on. next thing that you have is the likes of the Hashmal. Now, I love the Hashmal. Hashmal's been coming up everywhere I turn. It was in the Jerusalem Post last week. Did you see it? Yeah, anybody see it in the Jerusalem Post? Anybody read the Torah commentary a couple days ago? Did you see it? The Hashmal?
I don't remember it.
Yeah, it's in there. Build me a Mikdash. Build me a sanctuary that I might dwell among them. The argument on this as to how it applies relates back to the Hashmal.